Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. Thanks for joining me. So way back in the day, one of the very first guests on Tides of History was a well-known history podcaster and soon-to-be first-time author named Mike Duncan. 4 years later, he is a New York Times best-selling author of The Storm Before the Storm. He hosts one of the longest-running and most excellent history podcasts in the world, Revolutions, and he is in the process of releasing his second book, Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette in the Age of Revolution. Folks, Hero of Two Worlds is a fantastic read. It's available now, and you should buy it and read it. To tell us more about Hero of Two Worlds, Mike Duncan joins us once again. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me back.
So let's start with the most basic question. Why write a book about the Marquis de Lafayette?
I think the genesis for wanting to write a book about Lafayette comes directly out of doing the Revolutions podcast and where I was in the Revolutions podcast when it became time to think up, like, what am I going to do for book number two? Because as you said, I was here 4 years ago for my first book, Storm Before the Storm, which sold well enough that they let me write a second one. And when they came around to ask me, what do you want to write about? I was at this point in the show where this guy, Lafayette, had shown up in the Revolutions podcast in so many different places and in so many different time periods. And really, when I was talking about different parts of the world, that he became sort of the unofficial mascot of the Revolutions podcast at that point, because he shows up at this 19-year-old in the American Revolution series. And then we move on to season three, which is about the French Revolution. And he's sort of all over the place in the early stages of the French Revolution. And really, he's quite a major player all through 1789 and 1790 and 1791. And then my own sort of understanding of the guy is that then he's ejected from the French Revolution because he runs afoul of the Jacobins. And then he just sort of like goes off into retirement. And that's really the story of his life. But as I kept going, the guy just keeps showing up. He showed up in series four, which is about the Haitian Revolution, because Lafayette was an early abolitionist and he supported good relations with the Free Republic of Haiti after the Haitian Revolution. And then he shows up in season five during a series on Spanish-American independence, because he's like in correspondence with Simón Bolívar. He's sending gifts to Bolívar. Bolívar's writing back and saying like, oh, thank you. You know, you're the hero that we all aspire to be. And then I move into series six, which is about the French Revolution of 1830. And you've got, you know, 70-year-old Lafayette squeezing into his old National Guard uniform to go off and like overthrow a king. And even before that, he was involved in all of these secret underground liberal Carbonari conspiracies to overthrow Louis XVIII in the early 1820s. So by the time it came time for Lafayette, he finally dies in 1834. He's just been all over the place. There's no person who's been in the Revolutions podcast more than Lafayette over this, you know, really tumultuous and really important 50-year period in European and Atlantic history. And I said in the show, right, like Lafayette's been around so much that really he deserves a fuller treatment from me. And so I want to say, okay, Lafayette is dead now, but I want to write like sort of a deeper retrospective of his life. And as I was putting that together, that became the book proposal for my second book. And I just turned to my publisher and I said, I want to write a biography of this guy's whole life. He's fascinating. And most of this is not really ever been covered, even in his biographies that have come out. Most of it focuses on his adventures in the American Revolution and then the French Revolution without really covering anything about the whole back half of his life. And they said, we love it. Because of course, Hamilton had just come out. and they were thrilled that I was pitching a biography of the Marquis de Lafayette.
The stuff that you were talking about there, the kind of the second act of his life after the American Revolution and the French Revolution, I had no idea about. I had absolutely zero sense that he was a participant in all of those other events. How much of that was a surprise to you as you were going along? How much of that were you aware of? How much of that was kind of like a shock to you as you were going through that material?
The first time that I was going through it, like I just said, was everything after about 1791. Was a shock to me, because again, my understanding is he's a teenager. He's friends with George Washington. He helps us win independence. then he becomes a part of the French Revolution, but doesn't make it very far. Like, he gets evicted because he runs afoul of the Jacobins. He and the Jacobins were enemies. And then, you know, I was vague. Oh, I guess the one thing that everybody sort of knows is that he goes on this big return tour to the United States in 1824 and 1825. And sort of the narrative then is, as a young man, he's a revolutionary, and then a bunch of decades go by, and the next thing that happens to him is this return tour. And yeah, it really was uncovering step by step what happened to him during this whole, like, I guess, 40 more years of his life, up to and including 5 years spent in various German prisons, like dungeon, solitary confinement. That's actually what happens to him after the French Revolution. He's intimately involved in opposition to Napoleon Bonaparte's empire, and is like, him and Bonaparte have their own special relationship, because Bonaparte's always trying to get Lafayette to support the empire, and Lafayette's always trying to get Napoleon to give more political liberty to France. Lafayette is involved in the overthrow of Napoleon in 1815, and then he becomes a deputy in basically the French legislature after the Restoration, and he's involved in revolutions to overthrow, like I said, Louis XVIII, and he's involved in the Revolution of 1830. And then even after that, even after the Revolution of 1830, the revolt that happens in France in 1832, the June Revolt of 1832, which is what Les Miserables is set, is the background for Les Miserables, that revolt kicks off at his feet, because him giving a speech, a eulogy for General Lamarck in 1832, is the beginning of the June Revolt of 1832. So, like, really, it never stops. And the idea that Lafayette's career just sort of, he went into retirement and never came back, has been one of the biggest misconceptions that I think is floating around out there about him. And certainly, like, by the time that I learned about the seventh or eighth surprising thing about his life, that's when I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to spend a couple of years working this all out.
Well, the thing that is so fascinating about that is that it gets at a really basic point about this whole era. I mean, it's a really basic, but it's a really profound point. And I think your book does a great job of bringing that to the fore, is that the events of the Age of Revolution are all connected. Like, we might tell a separate history of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Revolution of 1830. We might tell those as separate things, but that's not how they unfolded. And that's not how people experienced them. It was the same people showing up over and over and over again.
Yeah. And this is something that did happen that I've certainly come to appreciate having made the shows, because I do tell these discrete revolutionary stories, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution. And for me, once I got into the Haitian Revolution, which was the fourth series, and we're kind of in this same like latter 1700s period, I began to understand and now fully believe that national histories as such are not really ever going to be able to tell the full story, or even really an accurate story of the way that that nation's history actually unfolded, because any nation, any people, any area is always going to be connected with other countries that are surrounding it, other people that are surrounding it. So American history, the history of the United States, is intimately involved in the history of France, and intimately involved in the history of the Caribbean, and intimately involved in the history of South America. Bolivar liberating South America is intimately involved with things that had already taken place in France, with events that had already taken place in North America. Right. So yeah, all of these things are happening at the same time. The same people are living through these events, and telling a complete story of what is essentially the history of the Atlantic Revolutionary period, which really gets going after the end of the Seven Years' War in 1763. And then you can say it really gets going in 1775 with the American Revolt, that goes then all the way to 1824, 1825, 1830, with the final liberation of Spanish America, you know, by Bolivar and San Martin and guys like that. And then the overthrow of the Restoration Bourbons in 1830, kicking off a whole new round of liberal revolts in Europe. These things, it's just one unfolding event. It is one giant unfolding event that, as I said in the show many times, it's like waves, like tides of history, right? Like tides of history. I didn't even mean to say that. Going back and forth across the Atlantic, and it would go up into Europe and into Africa, and then it comes back over to South America, the Caribbean, North America, and it just sort of sloshes back and forth over about 50 years until really the whole world is transformed into something different. And Lafayette is in the middle of all of this.
It feels like that's what makes him such a useful lens on this whole period, is that all of these people knew who he was. He influenced all of them. Like, what was his role in these things? So what was he doing showing up in the American Revolution? What was he doing in the French Revolution? What was he doing in these subsequent things? So we know that he was a direct participant earlier on, but was he a touchstone, an advisor for these later things? What were his roles?
Well, yeah. So early on, he's a soldier. And he's a general in the Continental Army. He ran away from home to go have a grand adventure, helping these British colonials break away from the hated British. And so in the American Revolution, he is serving as a soldier and he's serving as an aide to Washington, although he's not like an aide de camp the way that Hamilton was or John Lawrence was, because Lafayette was actually commissioned as a major general. So he's a soldier in the American Revolution. And then when he goes back to France, he leaves his military career behind and transitions into being like a philanthropist and a social reformer and a budding politician where, you know, Ancien Régime France was just awash in things that needed to be reformed, whether it comes to like religious toleration for Protestants, when it comes to like racial dynamics of the rights of people of color, or he, you know, very early in his career, like by 1783, he becomes an abolitionist and is in favor of emancipating all the slaves. Like anybody who is impoverished, he's looking to figure out ways to get them food relief and monetary relief. So he becomes a social reformer that leads him directly into the French Revolution, which is what an attempt at reform that then got wildly out of control and became a full-blown revolution, which he was quite happy about. His role in the French Revolution was as commander of the National Guard, which is the group, the citizen militia that was in charge of keeping the peace in Paris, which was an incredibly difficult thing for anybody to do. And this is partly how and why Lafayette gets ejected from the French Revolution, because he was the one who was supposed to be keeping order in what was fundamentally a disordered series of events. So he's in the mix of things at the nexus between popular uprisings and social reform and political reform and economic reform. And so that's him like as a young person, as a young politician. When he comes back around, you got to fast forward a bit to get past the fall of Napoleon and into Restoration France. By this point, he is an icon of what is almost a different world because he now has these kids like students, young Republicans, young liberals who were born in the later 1790s, who were born in the early 1800s, who weren't even around for the French Revolution. And they look at Lafayette and they see him as this living symbol, this person who is still a living link to a lot of this stuff that happened back in the 1770s and 1780s and 1790s. And they look at him as this sort of revered elder statesman. And he's getting letters from Greek revolutionaries, from Polish revolutionaries, Spanish-American revolutionaries, Portuguese revolutionaries, who were all looking at Lafayette as this symbol. And he is encouraging all of them. He's replying to all of them. He's not just taking their letters and like throwing them in the trash. He's encouraging national self-determination, political liberty, religious toleration, all of the things that we think of as sort of the liberal democratic outgrowth of this period in history. Lafayette is encouraging everybody to do it. And that's really kind of also his role in the Revolution of 1830. By this point, he returns to being head of the Paris National Guard, charged with keeping order, but also being the one who is channeling those liberal idealistic mentalities that had grown up as a result of everything that he had done. He remains the avatar for that all the way until he dies. And when he dies, you know, there's 200,000 people on the streets of Paris that are lining up for his funeral procession. He was still an extremely popular person when he died, an extremely well-known figure when he died. So he didn't even die in obscurity. He was still quite a famous person in 1834.
One of the things that comes through very clearly in your book is that Lafayette is a person of great principle. Where did these principles come from? How did he become so firmly rooted in ideas of liberal governance and reform?
This is actually a very interesting question because when he's young, like when he's a teenager, it's very clear that he is sort of looking to make his mark on the world by being like a glorious soldier. He wants to go fight in great battles and win great wars and win glory for himself and for France. But there was clearly some kernel inside of him that wanted to do more than sort of just be a famous soldier. He wanted to be a famous soldier on behalf of something that was noble, on behalf of something that was idealistic. And so the reason why he runs away specifically to join the Continental Army in the United States is because he was driven both by a desire to become a famous soldier and also because he saw in them, you know, however blinkered he was about like the hypocrisies of the United States of America, which are many and varied, but he saw in what they were trying to do something noble and something more idealistic than just, say, sovereign powers jockeying for territory or jockeying for position on the world stage. And so that sort of enters his heart. And from that point forward, from the time that he's a young man, wherever he looks, he's always going to be trying to make his world a better place. He sees things that are not working. He sees things that he believes are unjust, and he's going to try to resolve those. And that becomes sort of the basic mechanism of how he encounters the world. Anytime he looks around and sees things that are not as good as they could be, or as just as they could be, or as right as they should be, he was going to spend his time, his money, his energy trying to make the world that much of a better place. And that's really the thing that sticks with him, just that basic, the way that he encounters the world stays the same throughout his life. And because of the age that he's living in, coming out of the Enlightenment and then going through sort of the early liberal period in Europe, that means that he's on the side of political rights, religious toleration, freedom of speech, and the press, and all of these things that we now sort of take for granted, he believed were the things that always needed to be imposed wherever we're talking about, whether it's in Greece or Poland or Russia or Britain or, you know, Argentina. This is what's going to make the world a better place, is these liberal principles that he adhered to.
So from your perspective, was Lafayette like a capital G, capital M great man?
I think that Lafayette is just below the tier, capital G, capital M, great men. Because, I mean, and just to be clear about this, when we say great men, we do not mean the most awesome people in history. We do not, you know, it's not that. Because, you know, you look at somebody like Napoleon, who Lafayette was just adjacent to, right? And Napoleon and Lafayette had a long personal relationship with each other. They knew each other personally. And, you know, I think that Napoleon Bonaparte probably personally stamped more on world history than the Marquis de Lafayette did. And I don't think that that's any knock on Lafayette for saying that. And I also think that, for example, you take somebody like George Washington, for all of his many and varied faults and for all of the good things that he did, you know, George Washington has more of an impact on American history than the Marquis de Lafayette does, right? And so that's where you sort of get these great men whose personalities stamped the events within which they lived. Lafayette, on the other hand, is there for everything, a participant in everything, and he is channeling, I think, the spirit of the age. Like, if you get a little bit metaphysical about it, he is very much channeling the spirit of his age and his steadfastness in continuing to promote these principles. And like I said, the way that he spends his time, energy, money, efforts, and really at great personal cost. I mean, he loses a lot along the way. He is absolutely not a sunshine patriot in the way that, like, I will do these things as long as it's easy, but if it gets hard, then I'm going to quit. Lafayette was never somebody who quit in that way. So I think that, yeah, is he a capital G, capital M great man? No. Was he a capital V, capital G, very good man? Like, yeah, he's probably in the hall of very good when it comes to his place in history. And then, I mean, just since I'm thinking about this, like, one of the things that I do kind of like about him is there's a degree to which, if you truly are a great man, you've got a lot of bastard in you. You've got a lot of asshole in you, and you can be a bad person to it. And it sometimes takes being a horrible person to sort of rise to the level that we would discuss you in the conversation of great men, which Lafayette really wasn't ever that. He was always just a pretty good guy trying to do the best that he possibly could. And I didn't often encounter him being cruel, being indifferent, doing something that marks him as a terrible person, which you can go through the life stories of any of our great men throughout history, Julius Caesar, you know, Alexander the Great, whatever, and find tons of things that are just utterly reprehensible. Genocide, you know, like these very worst things.
Even Teddy Roosevelt just straight up loved killing things. Absolutely right. Loved killing. Just people, animals, loved killing.
Right. And so Lafayette, he's obviously not blameless. There's plenty that he does. And if you read the book, you'll find me, you know, knocking him for several things that I think he did that he was quite wrong to have done. But I just don't think he was ever like terrible as a human being to the people around him. And I think if that means that he didn't ever quite reach the level of great man status that some of the other people did, I think that actually speaks quite highly of him. It speaks well of him as opposed to negatively of him.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know what it feels like to feel like you're fighting a battle in your own head against something that's constantly interfering with your happiness and preventing you from achieving your goals. It's exhausting and it's painful, but therapy can really help. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your therapist. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit betterhelp.com/tides. That's better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional therapists in all 50 states. This is a special offer for Tides of History listeners. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/tides.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
There's an interesting bit kind of buried in there, which is that, you know, whenever people talk about judging past historical figures and that, well, don't apply present standards to them, don't apply present standards to them. Lafayette is a good reminder that there were people who had really good ideas that didn't necessarily pan out in the time, that weren't necessarily the most popular ones. But there were people before abolition became a widespread thing who were like, nah, slavery, pretty bad. We shouldn't do that. Right. There are people even before, you know, kind of liberal principles are the things upon which our society seems to be founded, who were like, oh, no, these are good things. Right. It's a good reminder that it like there are competing currents in every age, even if they don't necessarily win out. It's not like there's a unanimity of opinion on these really big, really important, divisive questions that we assign moral value to.
Right. And if you take the, you know, the obvious example of slavery, which is where you often hear this sort of brought up. He's like, oh, you can't judge George Washington or James Madison or Thomas Jefferson by the standards of our time when, you know, we know that slavery was wrong. And for them, it was just something they sort of took for granted. None of them took it for granted in the way that, like, they didn't think about it or they weren't constantly being told this is bad and wrong. And this is where Lafayette can enter the picture because, like I said, as early as 1783, this is really just after the end of the American War of Independence. He's writing to George Washington, who is his close personal friend. He will be writing to Thomas Jefferson, who's his close personal friend, and James Madison, his close personal friend, and not saying things like, well, you know, you do what you got to do. In order to make the American Revolution complete, we have to emancipate all the slaves. We have to abolish slavery. This is something we had to do. So those guys were hearing it directly from their close personal friend, the Marquis de Lafayette, who represents, as you say, the early turn towards abolitionism inside the white European community, because of course the other, you know, the greatest thing that you say about, oh, you can't judge a time period by today's standards. If you had gone to Monticello and asked around on Monticello, the population of that plantation, is slavery good or bad? You're going to find that like everybody there who were all slaves thought that slavery was bad. And to simply ignore their thoughts and feelings about it simply because they weren't a part of what was considered society, that too is an absolute failing, almost literally a whitewashing of history to not take their thoughts and feelings into account as well.
Yeah, that's a really, really excellent point. And it speaks profoundly to who gets to tell the story and whose perspective is identified with when we're talking about the past. Like those people had thoughts and opinions too. It's just that we don't get to hear them nearly as much because, you know, Thomas Jefferson is the one whose writings have come down to us as kind of hallowed documents related to the founding of the American Republic.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, the nice thing is that Lafayette was sitting right there reminding them of all of this stuff, telling them all of this stuff and prodding them as much as he possibly could to free your slaves. They didn't do it. They didn't listen to him. But you certainly can never say they weren't hearing it from people even close to them.
So this speaks to one of the things that I really love about your book and the way that you move really methodically, chronologically through Lafayette's life. By doing that, you stick the reader right in the middle of events as they played out. And for me, this really underscored the contingency of it, that stuff did not have to go down the way we're used to thinking that it did. The past that we think of and we know was not guaranteed. There were paths not taken. So looking at Lafayette from your perspective, were there moments that he participated in that might have gone differently? Were there, I mean, kind of counterfactuals or alternative paths that struck you?
Oh yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I'm a big believer in contingency in history and teaching contingency as a part of teaching history, because just because things went one way doesn't mean they had to have gone this one way. And in making the history of Rome and in making revolutions and in writing these books that I've read, I mean, almost literally every moment in history, every moment in time involves a myriad of different paths that could be taken. And so if you just go back to like his early life, you know, he was very nearly captured during the, what is, you know, sort of over dramatically called the Battle of Barren Hill. Very early in his career, he had only been in the Continental Army for about 6 months at this point. He was almost captured. And the story of the Marquis de Lafayette was very nearly French Marquis runs away from home and winds up getting humiliated and captured by the British and sent home in chains. And he becomes absolutely nothing. I mean, he avoided getting captured by literally by a couple of hundred yards. They managed to make it over this river before General Howe's army converges on him. His very first battle, the Battle of Brandywine, he takes a musket ball through the leg. You know, that could have gone through his heart. If it had been 2.5 feet higher, that goes through his heart instead of through his leg. When he goes back to France for the first time after his initial tour in the United States, his ship almost sinks in a storm. And then just a few weeks later, there's a mutiny on board that ship, right? And which they were going to drop Lafayette in Britain, like as a present for King George III. So all of these things, like at almost every moment of our lives, even our lives, not just historical figures, is just like we managed to live through, you know, like not having a meteor drop on our heads and kill us, or just die in a, just die in a plane crash or die in a car accident. Like life is a series, almost is a story of us avoiding all of the accidents that could possibly kill us. But then if you sort of take like a bigger picture view of things, you know, going through the French Revolution, I've sort of harped on this a number of times, that there was a constitutional monarchy that was sort of coming into being around about 1790, which was supposed to sort of tie the revolution up. And the revolution was supposed to be confined to this one year, 1789. And then France was supposed to move on as a constitutional monarchy. Lafayette is supposed to be the hero of this story and emerge as one of the principal leaders of the early French constitutional monarchy. And instead, it does not happen like that. And I think that that was largely driven by decisions inside the National Assembly to divide the people of France into active citizens and passive citizens, which is if you had just enough money, you were allowed to participate in politics and vote. And if you were poorer than this arbitrary line, then you were not allowed to participate in politics. But all of the people who had risen up and stormed the Bastille and marched to Versailles and brought the king and queen home from Versailles to Paris to keep the revolution going, to make the revolution possible, were then completely cut out of politics. And it's, I think, the backlash to that decision is what creates the sort of the more violent populist movement that erupts in 1791 and 1792, I think, is a backlash to all of that. So if the National Assembly had simply decided to go in a slightly more democratic direction in 1790 and in 1791, I don't think you get the whole rest of the French Revolution. I could go on and on and on about this. I think that almost every page in every chapter has some contingency built into it, that the life of Lafayette becomes just, you know, this one version of it, of what would otherwise be literally an infinite number of versions, many of which he's dead or in chains or humiliated or a complete non-entity.
So from that perspective, how has spending all this time with Lafayette changed your understanding of the age that he lived through?
It further solidified something we talked about earlier, which is how interconnected the people in this world were. I think looking back on them, we tend to view individual historical figures as being sort of aloof from everybody else, historical events as being aloof from other historical events that were happening at the same time. And when you run into somebody like Lafayette, you find out that, I mean, he's very much a sort of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with this guy, where he's connected to everybody. Like, you know, anybody you can think of, probably at some point, he's at least one person adjacent to. So these people were not living in separate bubbles and separate worlds. French history was not taking place separate from British history, and that wasn't taking place separate from the history of the United States of America. These things were interconnected, and people like Lafayette absolutely represent that. And then it also, you know, his bouncing back and forth between the United States and France gives a perspective of French history and a perspective of American history that is somehow integrated with both, but separate from both, if that makes like any sense at all. Because he was able to see French history both from sort of an insider's perspective and an outsider's perspective. And he's able to view the history of the United States both from the inside and from the outside. And I think it opens up a way to view the entire history of the Atlantic world as this single organic thing that is happening, as opposed to just merely having these parochial blinders on, which I think a lot of history does.
I was going to say, that's the thing that is so hard to do with biography, and that I think you have completely succeeded with in this book, is that you have made Lafayette a character with his own personality, but you haven't made him the driver of events. So he's a participant. We can see his agency in the way that you present him, but he's not in command of the situation because he's, as you put it, he's in the hall of very good rather than the hall of great. And that gives the reader a really profound perspective on these world-altering events, that you've got Lafayette as a guide, you've got him as a person who is doing things, but without overpowering everybody else who shows up in the story. Like, that's a really rare thing to be able to do in biography. It's a huge challenge, and you have succeeded in doing it.
Thank you. And there was actually something that was ultimately cut from the book because it got to not maudlin, but I think it got to a bit too like dreamy and poetic, was on his very first trip across the Atlantic after he runs away from home and he buys this boat, La Victoire, and him and some other French mercenaries are making their way across the Atlantic, and like just sort of the winds die. And so they're just kind of adrift in the Atlantic Ocean for a while. And, you know, this metaphor of being on the ocean that could at any time it wanted to, like just a storm could kick up and swallow this boat whole. That's a lot of what it means to live through history. It's a lot of what it means to just be a human on this earth. There are so many humongous forces that we have no control over that can swallow us up at any time, but we're still going to try to pick our way through things. We'll hoist the sails, we'll tack this way, we'll tack that way. And our ability to navigate events is as important as our ability to drive events. Right. And there is something to that ability to navigate things. It is an important lesson, I think, for humanity now more than ever. Like, how are we going to navigate the great things that are seeking to crush us, as opposed to how are we going to fundamentally control everything? Because that's not what it is to be a human being.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
For you, what is Lafayette's legacy or legacies?
Lafayette really represents, he is an avatar and a symbol for a great strain of political and social reform that sort of entered the human consciousness at this period in the later 1700s and then was carried on through the 1800s of how are we going to live with each other? What does it mean to be a society? And what does it mean to have a government? And, you know, what does it mean to live in a polity? What does it mean to be an individual? And prior to these great breaks in how we think about things, people were subjects of kings. You look at the timelessness of what the Catholic Church was selling during the Middle Ages, the timelessness of what the royalty was selling during the Middle Ages. And then if you even go back to the ancient world, there was very much the same stuff. There was a chain of being and a timelessness that was exalted. And by the time you get to the 1700s, we start getting this notion of like progress. Maybe we can improve things. Maybe we can make things a little bit better. Maybe we don't have to just live with stuff because this is the way it's always been. Maybe we can tinker with it and make it better. Now, there's obviously limitations to worshiping at the altar of capital P progress, but the idea of progress and the idea that we can make things better is, I don't think, fundamentally a bad thing. And when Lafayette enters this, what he represents is sort of the political dimension of this, which is that individuals should have rights. There should be things that the state and other people can't do to them, that free expression, freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, that these things are actually good, not just because they create a healthy and free society, but because it creates healthy and free individuals who are living within that society. People should be allowed to participate in the crafting of their own laws. These things should not just be handed down to us from on high. Like, we should be able to say yes or no. We should be able to send representatives to an assembly and participate in the crafting and the creation of our own society. So all of these things Lafayette is a living symbol of, and somebody who woke up every day inhabiting this ideal as a human being. And so when he dies and we look back on him, I think that his legacy is all of that stuff that we now do take for granted that was not to be taken for granted before. And it's why he's a revolutionary figure and a figure who fought constantly for stuff that was never just given to him and never just given to us. This is all stuff that we had to win by our own, you know, sweat and toil. And he represents all of those things for us.
Yeah, that it's hard to overstate just how radical a lot of those ideas were toward the end of the 18th century. It's really hard to explain to people who have been steeped in the kind of mindset that Lafayette represented, just how different the world could be in every way, but especially from the perspective of the idea of hierarchy and natural order, and that it's natural to be the subject of someone else, and that that's the thing that defines you, as opposed to your possession of individual rights. That, like, that's a really profound difference in the way that you live in the world and the way that you understand the world, and that there was no natural progression from one of those to the next, that that was a struggle, and is a struggle that took a very long time and that's still ongoing now.
Yeah. And I mean, you asked me earlier, like, where does this idealism come from? Like, why does he begin to inhabit this sort of stuff, this sort of mentality? And I think some of it is that he was, as a young man, immersed in this incredibly rich and incredibly powerful world out at Versailles. Like, he's running around in the same social circle as Queen Marie Antoinette and King Louis XVI. Like, he's in the very, very upper rungs of the French aristocracy, one of the most powerful aristocracies in the world at that point. And then when he runs away to the United States, because he kind of is not getting along with these people, he starts meeting people like Alexander Hamilton or Henry Knox or Benedict Arnold before Benedict Arnold, you know, becomes a bad guy when he was still a good guy. These guys were coming up from nothing. They weren't aristocrats. They didn't have noble blood. They were sort of rising up from nothing. And I think that Lafayette compared his encounters with these French aristocrats, who he was like, a lot of these people are kind of stupid. A lot of them are petty and mean-spirited. A lot of them are not really that capable of doing any of the jobs that they're supposed to be doing, but they get to do them. Why? Because they have this notion that their blood is somehow superior to that of commoners. And then he comes to the United States and meets a bunch of commoners who are doing great things and are very impressive intellectually, very impressive in terms of their willpower and stamina and ability to accomplish things. I think that that intersection, when those two things ran into each other, it all got blown up. And he was like, you know, the idea of people being judged off of their abilities and off of their merit, of their intelligence and their capabilities, rather than simply by their family tree, was a transformative moment in his life.
That's really fascinating, because it's one of the very difficult things to do, I think, especially with American history, is to look at figures like the founders in the context of their time, to appreciate what made them extraordinary. And there really were things that made all of those people extraordinary without idolizing them or making them into kind of historical demigods, right? Like, Alexander Hamilton was really smart and really talented. George Washington was really talented. Like, then there was a whole crew of people, like, in that generation who were really talented and worked really, really hard. So it's hard to appreciate that while still, like, rendering them human and fallible in our historical memory.
Right. And I think what you kind of take out of this is you would like people to be judged by what they did rather than who they are. And I still think something that is a good way to approach, you know, society today in terms of current events and also history. Judge them by what they did rather than who they are. And that can be, for people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, quite a double-edged sword. Because if you are asking me to judge you, not by who you are, but by what you did, You did a lot of good things, but also a lot of really horrible things. And I'm going to judge you for those things too. But I do think that it is in the main better to live in a world where talent is allowed to shine, where people are allowed to pursue their dreams and not simply be shut out of it because of who they are. And for somebody like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, of course, you represent the opening of that when it comes to like, I should be judged on my talents and my own individuality, while at the same time, they were enforcing a racial caste that absolutely excluded people from being able to achieve those same dreams and follow that same path. So yeah, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, you know, will ultimately be quite bloodied by that double-edged sword. But I do think that it's better to live in the world that they helped create and that Lafayette helped to create than in the world that went before him, which was all just, medieval nonsense.
Well, and what a fascinating...
No offense to The Bright Ages, which is a really good book. I'm reading it right now. I promise. I won't say anything bad about the Middle Ages.
But that's one of the really fascinating things about Lafayette too, is in the way in which he serves as a contrast to that. Because Lafayette, as you mentioned earlier, ends up in the Hall of Very Good, he gets to retain a certain purity of principle that more involved and more powerful figures lack. And it makes him fascinating as kind of an avatar for that whole age.
Yeah. And, the other very good part of him is that, I've sort of said this a bit tongue in cheek, is that basically Lafayette's not a genius, right? Like he's a smart guy, but he's not some towering intellect. And so when he learned about this thing called liberty, he just naturally assumed that that was going to mean the end of slavery, because liberty is a pretty simple concept and slavery is like the opposite of liberty. So how are you going to be able to reconcile liberty and slavery? And for a kind of a guy of maybe above average intelligence like Lafayette, he could never reconcile liberty and slavery. It sort of takes a towering intellect like Madison or like Jefferson to truly compartmentalize these two thoughts in their heads and be able to say all of these wonderful things about everybody being created equal while at the same time turning around and running this torturous slave plantation. Lafayette was never smart enough to reconcile those two things. And again, this is something that I think speaks quite well of him.
I'm absolutely dying at the idea of Lafayette as the Forrest Gump of the Age of Revolution.
Well, I think, he was a bit brighter than Forrest Gump, but he was definitely right there for it's just crazy, right? He's at Valley Forge with George Washington, and then you skip ahead 250 pages, and he's in a palace in Paris telling Napoleon to his face, you have to abdicate the throne now, right? It's the same guy who's present for all of these different events. It's absolutely true.
I can't think of a better reason to read this book than to get a sense for the sheer possibilities of this particular age. I can't recommend the book highly enough. It was a fantastic read. Mike, what are you going to do after this? Now that you've written two books and you've made two incredible podcasts, what are you going to do next?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm probably not going to say what I'm going to do next in terms of Revolutions is going to end. And people are like, well, what are you going to do after Russia? And it's like, well, first of all, I'm very clearly going through the Russian Revolution like one day at a time. So
it's going to take you a little while.
I don't know when the Russian Revolution is ever going to end, and I don't really care because I'm just going to do it at the pace I want to do it. I do have some ideas about what the next podcast would be because I am ready to move on to do something different. I think that that's fine. And there's a leader in the clubhouse in terms of what my next podcast would be, which I'm not going to say because if I change my mind, I don't want people to be mad at me for not doing the thing that I said I was going to do. This is just a little bit of navigating life with a fan base. But when it comes to the book, I would really like if Hero of Two Worlds sells well and the publisher comes back and says, okay, that one was also good, we'll let you write a third book. I very definitely want to go back to Roman history for my third book. And I would very much like to write a book about the crisis of the third century, that period when everything kind of fell apart around 230, 235 AD, and then wasn't put back together again until Diocletian in the mid 280s. Like that 50-year period remains fascinating, one of my most favorite parts of all of Roman history. and was the other thing that when I was writing it at the time, when I was doing the history of Rome at the time, I said, I really, really want to come back to this period at some point, which I did. It was the same thing that I believed about the period of the Gracchi and Marius and Sulla. When I left the history of Rome, I was like, I really want to come back to this period. And I did with The Storm Before the Storm. And so now I'd like to do the same thing and kind of go back to Rome, which I hope is exciting for everybody.
That would be very cool. The crisis of the third century is fascinating. And as far as I know, and I feel like I should probably know this, there is no good synthesis of the crisis of the third century. There's no good story. There's definitely not anything that really gives an up-to-date accounting, especially with kind of the archaeological evidence that's come out about the third century over the past few decades. I think even most Roman historians do not have a particularly strong grasp on it, like relative to what came before and after.
Yeah, my general sense of things is that to the extent that the period is covered in detail, it's usually a part of, like, you know, Rome from the Severans through Constantine or things like that. You know, they're covering like 150 years of which this is one of it, or they're covering 200 years of which, you know, this is one chunk of it. You know, in Fate of Rome, which is, you know, I think you like that book.
I love that book.
Yeah. Yeah, man, that's a good book. You know, so he's got a whole chapter on the crisis of the third century, but again, it's just a chapter, you know, and it's very good, but yeah, it doesn't get the blown up, you know, 350-page treatment, which I would really hope to give it.
Yeah, well, and I think, especially given the way that you think about contingency, I think you have a leg up in terms of understanding the crisis of the third century. I would just say, like, because it's never a given that the Roman Empire survives as a coherent unit through that. Like, there are multiple points in that period of time where fractures could have taken place. It's not like destiny that Aurelian's going to emerge, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And like, this is the thing where you know, that one of the great, you know, million-dollar questions of history is, why did the Roman Empire fall, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and one of the other ones is like, why did the French Revolution happen? So I always feel quite adjacent to these million-dollar questions in history. But for me, one of the even more interesting questions is, why didn't the Roman Empire fall in the mid-200s? What was it that allowed them to sort of come through that? And then the other, you know, just on a very sort of on a micro basis, people would often ask me, like, you know, this is the period where sort of like, if people know anything about it, they're sort of vaguely aware that there was this period where sort of like every 6 months there was a new emperor, and then somebody would become emperor and they would get assassinated or they would die in battle. And then, so like every six, there was like, you know, 13 emperors in 5 years. You know, it's crazy stuff like that. And people are like, why would anybody want to be emperor? Like, why would you do this if you knew that you were just going to get assassinated in 6 months? And the answer is because they didn't know they were going to be assassinated in 6 months. Every single one of these people believed they were the ones who were going to end the cycle. And I am now going to be emperor in perpetuity. And eventually that happens. A guy named Diocletian comes along after this run of, you know, 30 emperors in 12 years. And they're like, why would he want to be emperor? And then Diocletian goes on to be emperor for like 30 years. That's why, because every single one of them thought they were the one.
Yeah. It's funny. If you're willing to reach that high, you're not probably banking on a scenario in which you're going to be brought down. Like, if you really want to be emperor, you are probably fairly convinced that you're special enough to do the job for a while.
Exactly. And then they would just get shivved in the back and move on to the next emperor. Yeah, because none of them were. They were all quite second rate.
Yeah.
Except for Aurelian, the greatest emperor in Roman history.
So my wife's grandfather has an Aurelian coin, or had an Aurelian coin, that I saw for the first time last weekend. And I was like, oh man.
Oh man. Really?
I immediately thought of you. Yeah.
That's cool.
I thought,
that's my boy.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was fitting given that we were going to talk this week. Mike, all the best with the book. Best of luck. Sincerely, everybody should go buy Hero of Two Worlds. It's a fantastic read. If you listen to this show and you like this show, it is going to be right up your alley. I absolutely promise you. I have purchased a copy for my dad that I'm sure he will enjoy when we were at the beach on vacation. So I'm just really stoked that this is out there in the world. I read it a few months ago and I really, really enjoyed it. So Mike, thank you for coming on. Thank you for writing this book. And I cannot wait to have you on again.
Thank you for all of those things you just said. And can't wait to come back.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen early and ad-free. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.